course, the Countess said. Greyland nodded. You are very lucky to have Lady Kiva as your director, Countess Nohama Peaton, she said. Aside from her clever solution to this minor problem, her uncovering of the widespread graft and corruption within your organization must be a great relief to you.
Yes, quite, the Countess answered, not looking at Kiva at all.
It would have been unfortunate if such practices had leapfrogged from the in-system organization to the Nohama Peaton organization at large, Greyland continued. Then the Ministry of Revenue and the Ministry of Justice would be obliged to step in. She glanced over to Kiva. But you do not believe that such a thing is the case?
Not yet, Your Majesty, Lady Kiva said. But of course our investigation is not yet over.
How long do you think it will take, Lady Kiva?
Given the complexity of the House of Nohama Peaton income streams and books, and the sophistication of the skimming from each, several more months, I think.
Several more months, Greyland said, with a very slight emphasis on the word months.
At least, yes, Kiva amended.
Greyland returned her attention to the Countess Nohama Peaton. We have no doubt you are extending your director here every courtesy and cooperation while she sounds the extent of your local organization's issues, Countess.
Yes, Your Majesty.
But yes, Countess, while Lady Kiva has shown great ingenuity.
The Countess is too kind with her praise, Kiva interjected, knocking the Countess off balance. I must admit, however, that there was almost no ingenuity on my part here. To discover these lapses, all it took were fresh eyes.
Someone from the outside, you would say, Lady Kiva? Greyland asked.
Perhaps that's all that was needed, yes, Kiva replied.
Greyland slapped the arms of her throne lightly. In that case, we believe it's best to have those outside eyes continue to look into the issues with the in-system Nohama Peaton business and to help this branch of a great house return to form.
And of course, in your continuing role as director, Lady Kiva, you will remain in contact with the Countess directly to keep her informed on what you find, as you will keep us informed to the same extent.
Of course, Your Majesty, Kiva said. The House of Nohama Peaton is of great interest to us, Lady Kiva, Greyland said. You have a great responsibility, both to it and to us.
I understand, Kiva intoned. She glanced over at the Countess, who, it must be said, was holding her outrage in admirably.
Now, Countess, let us discuss your daughter, Greyland said.
Ma'am?
The Countess Nohama Peaton said, thrown entirely off track by this. Our understanding was that this was the reason for your visit, Greyland said.
In fact, ma'am, we came to discuss the matter of Lady Kiva.
Well, we've settled that, have we not?
Greyland asked.
And on the matter of your daughter, we have an interest to speak to you, if you wish to hear it.
Kiva saw the Countess momentarily and almost imperceptibly weigh her desire to revisit the matter of extracting Kiva from her business against the possibility of irritating this emperor who was currently in the process of railroading her sorry ass all around the room. She took the cowardly way out.
I am happy to speak of my daughter, ma'am. Your daughter is accused of some of the most grievous crimes, Countess. Murder? Attempted assassination? Treason? These crimes, if she is found guilty of them, come with the penalty of death.
The Countess paled a bit at this.
Yes, ma'am. It grieves me that she finds herself in this position, Countess Nohama Peaton. At one point we thought she might be our sister, married to our brother Renarid, who was to be emperor. Things would be very different now. Had he lived to succeed our father.
Yes, they would, the Countess said.
They would indeed. We cannot say what may have led Nadashe to the crime she is accused of. We cannot stop what must happen. She must be tried, And, when tried, if she is found guilty, she must be punished. We must all face the law and justice. You understand this, Countess Nohama Peaton?
I do. The Countess looked down at the room's exquisite mosaic floor.
Greyland nodded. Nadashe must face the law, and must face justice, and must be punished, she repeated. And yet, in earnest of my brother's love for her, and to honor the loyalty you have pledged your house to, I can offer some mercy.
The Countess looked up. Your Majesty?
Life instead of death, Greyland said. If she is found guilty of any of the capital crimes she is accused of and is sentenced to death, I will commute the sentence to life imprisonment, and she will serve that sentence here on Xian at Silent Water.
Kiva blinked at this. Silent Water wasn't so much a penitentiary as it was a vacation camp you couldn't leave. It was where ministers of parliament went when they were caught taking bribes or accountants caught embezzling funds. It was the only penal facility on Xian on the basis that one doesn't want to house hardened criminals in the same habitat as the Emperor. To house Nadashe there when she straight up murdered dozens of people, including her brother, was giving her a huge fucking break. Greyland might as well be giving her an ice cream cone while she was at it.
Is that acceptable to you, Countess Nohama Peaton? Greyland asked.
Kiva watched the Countess Nohama Peaton roll through several sets of emotion on her face, some so quickly that Kiva wasn't sure she actually saw them. Then the Countess looked directly at Greyland again and gave that fucked up curtsy bow whatever again.
Of course, Your Majesty, she said to the Emperor. Thank you.
Greyland nodded and stood.
We have accomplished much today, she said. We are glad of it. And now you must excuse us, as we have another appointment which we will soon be late for. Countess Nohama Peaton, Lady Kiva, Ms. von der Polonin.
Greyland gave a small bow, which the three of them returned and held until the Emperor had made it to the door behind the dais from which she had entered. The door closed.
What the fuck were you even doing here?
The Countess Nohama Peaton lashed at von der Polonin. Von der Polonin opened her mouth to reply, but the Countess stormed off toward the entrance, looking like the world's most pissed-off peacock. Kiva watched her go. I don't know what she's so upset about, she said to von der Polonin. I thought that went very well. Von der Polonin looked at Kiva with narrowed eyes.
This was a setup, she said.
Are you fucking kidding me? Kiva said. Your boss walks in here with an obvious plan to insult Greyland, and when her ass is handed to her, you whine about a setup? She nodded in the direction of the departed furious Countess. This wasn't a setup. It was a massacre, pure and simple. Your boss made the mistake of assuming the Emperor was weak and got stuffed. She got stuffed so hard, you never had a chance to make the argument that I should be out of a job.
And you didn't speak to the Emperor about this at all?
We're not friends, Kiva said. We don't have fucking sleepovers where we style each other's hair and giggle about boys. This is the second time I've ever met her. Don't get me wrong, Kiva said. The way she crushed your boss just now was fucking spectacular. She didn't get a chance to object to me. You didn't get to bring in your sabotage gambit. The Emperor made it clear that she was going to watch what happened to me and your local businesses very closely. Then she rubbed the Countess's nose in the fact her daughter was a murderer and a traitor and made her thank her for telling her that her kid would spend the rest of her life in prison.
Von der Polonin looked at Kiva strangely. Is that what you thought just happened?
I was here for it, so yes, actually.
Von der Polonin shook her head.
You don't understand. When Greyland said that she would commute Nadashe's death sentence and house her on Xian, she wasn't being gracious.
She wasn't even rubbing the Countess's nose in the fact that Nadashe will be in prison all her life.
She was telling the Countess that she was making Nadashe a hostage, right here on Xian, where the Emperor can get to her if the Countess ever gets out of line again. How could you miss that, Kiva? How could you miss that the Emperor made an enemy of the Countess today? Countess Nadashe will never forget what Greyland did today. And she will never, ever forgive it.
Chapter 8. Greyland II did have another appointment that she was about to be late for. Truth be told, she always had an appointment that she was about to be late for. But the appointment she was about to be late for was one where, at least, she would not have to be Greyland II. She was meant to be having a meeting with Marse Claremont, which meant she would get to be Cardenia Wu Patrick for the 30 minutes or so they would have together. The fact that the meeting was 30 minutes was, in itself, something of a luxury. To get 30 minutes with the Emperor these days, you had to be the Minister of State or the Archbishop of Xi'an or some major human habitat had to be on fire. But Marse Claremont got 30 minutes because, one, he was the linchpin to understanding the changes in the flow that were currently affecting the interdependency, and no other flow scientists had caught up with him. And two, Cardenia had a crush on him and liked spending time looking at him.
"Are you all right, ma'am?" asked her assistant, Obelise Atek, who was ferrying her to the next appointment. "I'm fine," Cardenia said. "Why?" "You look a little flushed all of a sudden." This made Cardenia flush a little more. "It's nothing," she said. "I was thinking back on something the Countess Nohama Peten said." "That bad, ma'am?"
"It could have been worse," Cardenia said, although at the moment she wasn't sure how. Cardenia was aware the Countess had been furious at the outcome of the meeting. She'd been sure she was going to roll the Emperor and take back control of her local holdings.
"This is the nice thing about being underestimated," Cardenia thought. It wasn't the first time recently that she'd outmaneuvered someone because that other person thought she was slow or naive or simply too nice to be anything more than an obstacle to be maneuvered or to be maneuvered around.
Cardenia remembered that when she'd started as the Emperor, she felt mildly offended that people thought she could be flattered or intellectually bullied into a position or decision. Then she'd spent time talking to the ghosts of her predecessors in the memory room and learned just how much flattery and bullying had worked over the centuries. It didn't leave her with a positive impression either of the former emperors or of the people who wheedled concessions out of them. She also learned the value of letting people assume she was less than capable up until the moment she disabused them of the notion. Like she just had with the Countess Nohama Peten, the Countess wouldn't do that again. That's not necessarily a good thing, one part of Cardenia's mind pointed out, and that was true enough. You were underestimated once, and then when you rubbed someone's face in it forever after, that trick was out of the toolbox.
"I'm the Emperor," Cardenia thought. "I do have other tricks."
And that was also true enough.
"Enough of the Countess Nohama Peten," another part of Cardenia's brain said. "We were thinking about Marse."
This part of her brain, Cardenia realized, might be a swoony 15-year-old. But, well, Marse. There was a puzzle, wasn't it?
"I don't know what to do," Cardenia had admitted to the ghost of her father, Ottavio VI, in the memory room the night before.
"Have sex with him," Ottavio VI said.
"It's not that simple," Cardenia protested.
"It is, actually," Ottavio VI replied. "You're the Emperor."
"And what, I just command him into my bed?"
"It's been done before."
"Not by me," Cardenia said. "Leaving everything else aside, I'm not built that way."
"Then invite him," Ottavio VI said. "Less problematic, mostly equal success rate, historically speaking."
"How often did you do that?" Cardenia asked.
"Before I answer, I will remind you that I, as a computer simulation of your father, have no ego to defend, and thus will answer entirely truthfully," Ottavio VI said. "I mention this because at several points in the past, I answered questions for you, and it made you unhappy. Perhaps you might ask the question of another emperor to whom you are not emotionally attached."
"You're saying the answer will make me unhappy?"
"Yes, basically."
"Well, now I have to know," Cardenia said.
"I did all the time," Ottavio VI said. "It was a pretty great perk of being Emperor."
"Oh, God,"
Cardenia said and buried her face in her hands. You're right. I didn't want to know. It worked on your mother, Ottavio the Sixth said. I especially didn't need to know that. In her case, it led to something more. But you have to know, it started because I invited her. And like nearly everyone else, she didn't refuse. You understand that doesn't make it better, right? Cardenia said. I never coerced anyone, Ottavio the Sixth said. I was turned down from time to time, and I never asked again in those cases. There's never a need for that, especially when you're emperor. And you don't think being emperor wasn't a substantial factor in people accepting? That they might feel pressure to have sex with you because you could, say, wreck their lives? There's no need for that, either, Ottavio the Sixth said. It's just sex. And it worked the other way as well. There were people who wanted to have sex with me because I was the emperor. They wanted a story to tell their grandchildren. They wanted it more than I did. And you fulfilled their wishes because you were selfless, Cardenia said sarcastically. No, I did it because I wanted sex too, Ottavio the Sixth said. Just not as much. Remind me never to ask you for romantic advice ever again. I have recorded that request and will remind you of it should this ever come up again. Thank you. With that said, you have to be aware that you will never stop being the emperor, Ottavio the Sixth said. You will always be more powerful than the people you will be interested in. If you don't want to be alone or to have your sexual and emotional needs tended to by a professional, you will have to accept that as part of your landscape. I haven't had sex since I've been emperor, Cardenia admitted. That doesn't seem healthy. I don't like it much either, but that's part of the problem, too. I don't want Mars to think I'd be using him strictly for tension release. I'm not sure I'm qualified to talk to you about this, Ottavio the Sixth said. I'm a computer simulation of your father, not a licensed relationship therapist. I doubt this rises to the level of therapy, Cardenia said. If you say so, Ottavio the Sixth said, and it bothered Cardenia that a computer simulation could perfectly mimic doubt. Perhaps you should just tell this person you like them. The worst that can happen is he says no. I know. And then you can have them exiled. No, Cardenia said, and then paused. Did you just make a joke? If it will make you feel better about what I just said, then yes, I did, said Ottavio the Sixth. As Cardenia walked through the Imperial Palace toward her personal apartments, she realized that her father, or the computer simulation thereof, was not wrong. Ultimately, Mars and she were adults and could approach this in an adult manner. She suspected he liked her as well, but was shy about making any first move. First, because he was kind of a nerd, and second, because she was, after all, the emperor, and despite her father's attestations otherwise, Cardenia suspected it took nerves of steel to let an emperor know you were into them. Mars, entirely understandably, was waiting for Cardenia to make that first move. All right, then, I will, Cardenia said to herself. It's been weeks since we met. It's time. The worst that can happen is he says no. Cardenia walked into her apartments, nodded goodbye to Atek, who made her way back to her own office until she was called for, and then walked into her private dining room, where she knew Mars would be waiting, and was, in fact, waiting. With another woman. Who the hell are you? Cardenia blurted before she could stop herself. We're calling it evanescence, Mars said. Flow streams that arise out of the shifting of the flow topography in our part of space. So even as the streams that we've seen as long-term and stable are collapsing, and they are, these other streams will arise and connect star systems for an indeterminate period of time. Right, said Hatid Roinald, the woman Mars had brought to their engagement. Although by indeterminate, we don't mean that we can't estimate how long the stream will remain open. We can, probably. What we mean is that the individual streams might be open for a day or a couple of weeks or even years. But they'll still collapse quickly relative to the streams we've been used to, the ones that were open for 1,000 years, Mars said. That's why we're calling the phenomenon evanescence. Now you see them, now you don't, Roinald said. Cardenia nodded dumbly at the two of them as they raced through the details of their latest discoveries and tried to gather her thoughts. She had made a mess of her entrance, and neither Mars nor Roinald had seemed to figure out why exactly that was.
Mars had apologized for springing Roinald on Cardinia, but noted that he had cleared the addition with the Emperor's secretary and assumed that Cardinia knew he was bringing a guest. This was entirely possible, since Cardinia had not bothered to check her own personal schedule on her tablet between her appointments, on the basis that she knew where she was going and with whom she was having her next meeting. Roinald's presence meant that she was essentially harmless to Cardinia. Security would not have cleared her as an addition if she could have been in any way a threat. Mars had brought Roinald because of all the flow physicists currently cranking their way through the Count Clermont's work on the flow collapse. She was the only one who was already up to speed on the work. She had done her own work on the subject, albeit only relatedly, and also for the Nohama Petans, who then used her work to try to overthrow the interdependency. No one seemed to be holding it against Roinald, however. Apparently not the Imperial Guard, which allowed her into the palace, and clearly not Mars, who was talking animatedly with her, with the both of them trading off sentences. Cardinia watched the way the two of them talked about the subject of the flow, and was aware of a tang of jealousy creeping into her emotions. Mars and Roinald had a communion of ideas that felt to Cardinia like love at first sight. They were obviously into each other, or at least into each other's brains. Roinald was a bit older than Mars, but that wouldn't be that much of an impediment if everything else lined up. "Maybe you should actually pay attention to what they're saying to you," that one annoying voice in her head said. "You can moon after the boy later." Cardinia made a note to try to find that voice later and strangle it, possibly with alcohol. So Cardinia held up a hand to stop the both of them from talking. Mars picked up on it right away. Roinald kept prattling on until Mars put a hand on her shoulder to stop her. Cardinia noted it and felt a small pinprick in the general area of her heart. "I don't need to know the details here," Cardinia said. "I wouldn't understand the details, even if you tried to tell them to me. And I have to be at another meeting in a few minutes, so let me see if I understand what you're saying so far." "Okay," Mars said. "One, the flow streams are still collapsing." "Yes," Mars said. "Two, every once in a while, a new flow stream will appear where there wasn't one before." "Yes." "Three, these new flow streams are only around for a short time. They won't replace the old streams." "Yes." "Well," Roinald said. "Well, what?" Cardinia asked. "Our preliminary work," Roinald began. "And this is all super preliminary," Mars interjected. "Shows that eventually a new network of flow streams with long-term stability is likely to appear in this part of space. Like I'd predicted before, for the Nohama Petans," Roinald finished. Cardinia looked up at Mars, confused. "Is this accurate?" "Well," Mars began. "Because if this is accurate, then I have a whole lot of questions for you, Lord Mars. Not all of them friendly. I've risked a whole lot on your predictions being correct." Mars held up a hand and then pointed at Roinald. "Ask her what eventually means in this context." Cardinia directed her attention to Roinald. "And what does eventually mean in this context, Dr. Roinald?"
"Somewhere between 5,000 and 8,000 years from now," Roinald said.
Cardinia looked back at Mars, confused.
"Dad and I were right," Mars said. "The flow streams as we know them are going to collapse soon and go away for a very long time, enough time to bring about the effective end of civilization if we don't act."
He pointed again at Roinald.
"She was also right. The flow streams are eventually likely to reestablish themselves in this part of space in a different configuration than they are in now. She was just off on the time scale."
"No one to check my math," Roinald said.
"And we both missed something else until we had access to each other's work," Mars continued. "The evanescence, I mean. It doesn't change the fact the flow streams are collapsing. It doesn't change that the interdependency is threatened, but it might buy us all a little more time to deal with it."
"How so?"
"You asked if new flow streams will open up where there weren't once before," Mars said. "That's correct, and some will, but there's another effect, too."
"Collapsed ones will open back up again," Roinald said. "Sometimes, not for very long."
"But long enough to send ships through," Mars said.
"Maybe," Roinald said. "Depends."
"And bring them back again," Mars said.
"Again, maybe, and depends," Roinald said.
"Which brings us to the next thing," Mars leaned forward. "And this is a big thing."
"It's really big," Roinald said.
"What?" Cardinia asked, switching her view between the two of them.
"What is it?"
Hatid predicted a previously closed flow stream would be opening up imminently. After the Tir Hatun stream closed, I tasked one of our drones to go to where this previously closed flow shoal used to be.
And? Cardenia said.
It went through, Reynolds said. The flow stream has opened up again, and the one coming back, too, both of them back in business.
Not for long, Mars warned.
No, Reynold agreed. They're both going to collapse again. The outgoing stream in about a year, the incoming stream much sooner than that, say 3 months?
Why the difference? Cardenia asked.
It's like I told you when I first met you, Mars said. The incoming and outgoing streams aren't actually related. And there's this.
He nodded over to Reynold.
The incoming stream has been open for almost 5 years, Reynold said.
Cardenia blinked at this.
How is that possible? The flow doesn't do what it does on our schedule, Reynolds said. The current shift has been happening for decades, maybe even centuries.
No, Cardenia said, slightly annoyed. I mean, how did we miss this open flow shoal hanging out in hub space?
Reynolds shrugged. You weren't looking for it, nothing was coming out of it, and the outgoing flow shoal had collapsed so long ago, probably no one has thought about it for centuries.
Except maybe for you, Mars said to Cardenia, who threw up her hands, exasperated.
Could you please stop being mysterious and just tell me already?
It's Dallas Isla, Mars said.
The lost star system of the interdependency, and the reason your namesake was assassinated.
Cardenia was stunned silent by this.
Ask her,
Reynolds said, eventually to Mars.
Ask me what?
Cardenia said, also looking to Mars.
We think we should go, Mars said.
To Dallas Isla.
Why?
Because it's the system we lost, Mars said.
What happened there could happen to every other system in the interdependency. We need to go and find out what we can about how everything broke down, so we can learn how to avoid their mistakes.
And we need to do it soon, Reynolds said, before the incoming stream collapses again.
Hatid's right. We need a ship, and we need it soon.
And you would want to go on the ship, Cardenia said.
Of course, Mars said and smiled. It'll be the most important scientific expedition in hundreds of years. I wouldn't want to miss it.
He looked over to Reynolds.
Neither of us would.
It was close to midnight before Cardenia finally said fuck it to herself and sent for Mars Claremont.
What sort of scientists are you going to need for this expedition? She asked when he appeared hastily in her apartments.
His own apartment was in the staff wing of the palace, some distance away.
Cardenia knew Mars had his own money. His father had sent him to Hub with a substantial portion of his family's wealth and a personal data vault. But Mars Claremont was apparently happy in what was essentially a studio apartment with a lavatory attached. He had walked the several minutes from his apartment to hers, stopping through layers of security on the way. The two of them stood, somewhat awkwardly, in her drawing room, a bit of a distance apart.
I think we'd need all kinds, Mars said carefully.
Cardenia could tell he wasn't aware why he'd been summoned. And now that she'd asked the question, he wasn't sure why this needed to be answered at 11:55 at night.
Flow physicists, obviously, but I'd also think we'd want biologists, chemists, astrophysicists, ordinary physicists, anthropologists and archaeologists.
Archaeologists?
Dallas Isla has been dead for centuries, Mars said. We need people with an understanding of how to process that sort of history. We'd need forensic scientists and pathologists. We'd need historians, particularly the ones with a knowledge of Dallas Isla and the early interdependency. We also need engineers and people who are familiar with the computers and systems of the era. That's who I can think of off the top of my head. I can write you a longer report if you like.
What if I wanted to keep this small, Cardenia said.
Small and quiet.
Why would you want to do that? Mars asked.
Because right now, the fewer people who know about it and about the evanescent flow streams you and Reynolds have discovered, the fewer headaches I have to deal with trying to explain everything without you around, Cardenia said, and then caught Mars's look. I'm not saying I want to keep this classified forever. I'm saying I want to know what this expedition has found out about Dallas Isla before I make any announcements.
Other flow physicists have been working on the data we've given them, Mars pointed out. Some of them might find out about this anyway.
They're working on your and your father's data, yes?
That's right.
And not Reynolds,
no.
Then it's a risk worth taking.
If you think so.
I do. Back to my question. Small and quiet. How many scientists would you need then?
We could double up jobs, Marsh said. Flow physicists. We can do without the other sorts because we are schooled in general and classical physics, and we can make observations available for others to work with. A forensic pathologist who has some general biological expertise? There are lots of archaeologists who have experience in anthropology and vice versa. We'd still need someone familiar with the computer systems of the time, and someone familiar with the habitats of the era as well. Maybe those could combine?
So 5 or 6, depending.
I suppose. Plus an actual crew for the ship.
How much time would you need at Dalla Sisla?
However much time you want to give us.
Give me a time frame, Mars.
2 weeks minimum, I would think.
How long there and back?
We estimate about 8 days going from the data we have and the historical data about the system. We're confident this is a reopened flow stream and not a new stream mimicking the previous stream. But there's a plus or minus of about 3 days.
So, maximum 11 days there, 2 weeks at Dalla Sisla, 11 days back. That's more than a month.
Now you know why we want to get this expedition going sooner than later, Marsh said.
Why would you need 2 flow scientists, Cardenia asked, if you're doubling up expertise with everyone else?
Marsh looked a little hesitant at this. I don't think that's a question of need, he said.
Then what is it?
This is our discovery, Marsh said, both mine and Hatid's. We both want to be part of it, and I think we both deserve to be part of it. I wouldn't want to ask her to stay here for it, and I definitely want to be part of it. Maybe it's a luxury in terms of personnel, but I think we can afford it.
What if I asked you to stay behind? Cardenia asked.
Mars gave Cardenia a very slight smile. Asked, he said.
Asked, Cardenia said, not ordered.
Your Majesty, if the Emperor asks for something like this, one would be foolish to see it as anything other than an order. Cardenia had a momentary flashback to her discussion with her father's ghost the night before on the distinction between an Emperor commanding or inviting someone to bed.
Oh, forget it, she said, and walked over to her bar to pour herself a drink.
I'm confused, Marsh said after a moment. Join the club, Cardenia said, and put ice into a tumbler.
What am I missing here? Marsh said.
Cardenia poured the drink, slugged back a non-trivial amount, and then set her glass down.
I'm really, really bad at this, she said.
Bad at what?
Look, are you with Reynold?
Cardenia asked Mars.
What? Are you with Reynold? Are you two, you know?
Cardenia made wavy motions with the hand holding the tumbler, sloshing the liquid as a result.
A thing? An item? Romantically involved?
Cardenia watched as Mars, bless his stupid, oblivious, nerdy heart, finally put it together.
No, he said. No, we are not an item. We are not romantically involved.
Are you sure?
Cardenia pressed. I saw the two of you talking this afternoon. You were very animated together.
It's because we're the only two people in the entire system who know what the other one is talking about, Marsh said. When it comes to the flow, at least, it's like finding the only other person in the world who speaks your language.
Well, see, that's what I mean, Cardenia said, and finished the rest of her drink. She went over to refill her tumbler.
The language is flow physics, Marsh said. It's specialized. It's very abstruse. And it's not at all romantic.
Are you sure that's what Reynold thinks?
You think she has a thing for me?
Maybe.
I don't think I'm her type, Marsh said.
What do you think her type is?
Mathematical symbols, mostly. If you spent any time with her, you'd know she doesn't really like humans all that much.
She likes you.
She accepts dealing with the fleshy parts of me as part of the price of getting to work with my brain. It's not exactly the same thing. Cardenia was quiet for a moment.
So, Nothing between you two at all. If civilization survives, we might go down in history as the co-discoverers of the Claremont-Roynald theory of flow stream distribution along with my dad, Marsh said. But otherwise, no.
Well, fuck, Cardenia said. She looked into her drink and then looked back up at Marsh. Did I mention I am really, really bad at this?
Marsh grinned. You did. He motioned to the tumbler in Cardenia's hand, which she had replenished. May I ask you to put that down, please?
Why?
Because if we're about to have the conversation I think we're going to have, I'd like to think it wasn't the booze talking.
You could have said no, you know, Cardenia said after, as they lay in bed in a classic snuggling pose.
Why would I do that? Marsh said. You're the Emperor. You could have me shot.
Cardenia swatted him lightly. That's my point. I didn't want you to think this was some sort of command performance, that I was hitting you up because you couldn't say no.
Trust me, after tonight's conversation, I would never think you were commanding me into your bed.
Oh, God, Cardenia said and buried her face in Marsh's chest. Don't remind me. I will never live it down.
I thought it was sweet. I swear to you, I'm not actually the jealous type. That was something else entirely.
What was it?
It was the, he likes someone else and now I'm sad and want to go eat an entire pie thing.
That's a very specific thing.
Well, pie is amazing. Cardenia lifted up her head and kissed Marsh.
But I like this better.
I'm very happy to know I'm better than pie, Marsh said.
Don't knock it.
I'm not.
You still want to go on that Dalla-Cecil expedition, don't you? Cardenia said a minute later.
Yes, of course, Marsh said.
I could go with you.
I think the Interdependency might notice if the Emperor suddenly went missing.
That's not entirely true, Cardenia said. Samuel III would disappear for entire months. Nobody much missed him.
You may be more critical to the well-being of the Interdependency than Samuel III, whoever he was.
That's possible.
And, given the amount of controversy you've kicked up recently, people would definitely notice if you were gone.
Cardenia looked up at him again.
That's a sly reference to the visions, isn't it?
I'm going to shut up now, Marsh said.
So? What do you think of them, really?
Does it matter?
Yeah, to me it matters.
What I think is that Emperor Greyland II is doing everything that she can to make sure that civilization and all the humans in it survive past the next 10 years. And because that's what I think, if she's having visions and they help humanity survive, then I'm all for them.
Cardenia kissed Marsh again.
Thank you.
I mean, I would have been happier if you just leaned into the science more, Marsh said.
Maybe next time. Cardenia said.
Marsh snorted at that.
How do you feel about the Imperial Navy? Cardenia asked.
I've never really given them much thought, Marsh said.
Why?
Because I'm going to requisition a ship, crew, and scientists from them to get you to Dalla-Cecil and back. They can do it quickly and quietly, and no one asks any questions when the Emperor has a mission for the Navy.
Well, Cardenia amended, people will ask, but they won't ask them out of the chain of command.
When will they be ready?
I'm going to tell Admiral Emblod I want them ready in a week. 5 days if he can manage it.
That's fast.
Yes, it is. Cardenia hauled herself up on top of Marsh. And that's because you have to go on this expedition, and I want you back as quickly as you can get back, because whatever this is, I want to get back to it as soon as possible.
Book 2. Chapter 9. Cal Doric had managed to spring Nadashe Nohama Peten from prison for exactly 8 hours.
The judge finally agreed to give us a hearing on your mental state, Doric told her at their weekly meeting. I'm making the argument that your time here is an assault on your already fragile mental state and that you need to be placed in a secure mental facility instead.
The prosecution is fighting this, obviously, so the judge has asked for you to be present so he can evaluate you himself. Because who needs an actual medical degree in psychiatry when you have a law degree and an oversized opinion of your own importance?
And
We think that being in a mental institution is going to be better than being here, Nadasha asked.
It's not optimal, no. But it beats being somewhere people are trying to stab you with spoons.
I thought we were sticking to the story that the lady with the spoon and the lady with the toothbrush just happened to be stabbing each other as I was innocently walking by.
Nadasha could see how heroic Doric was in his effort not to roll his eyes.
Fine. It beats being somewhere people are spontaneously trying to shiv each other whenever you just happen to be walking by. What became of the toothbrush lady anyway?
I believe she's still in solitary. Apparently it was not her first toothbrushing.
You meet such interesting people, Lady Nadasha.
And yet, here I am with you.
Doric raised a finger as if to say, a touch, I do admit it.
To get back to business. We're up in front of the judge in 2 days, so you know the drill. They'll come and shackle you up, take you up the elevator to the surface level, and chain you up in the overland wagon. I made noise about your security, so you'll be happy to know you'll be solo in your chariot. And by solo, I mean you'll only have 3 armed guards with non-lethal, but I am promised, nevertheless, extraordinarily painful stun sticks and shotguns. This is apparently a precaution for if you have a burst of adrenaline and burst your chains or smuggle a lockpick into the wagon by some method I am not paid enough to imagine. Which reminds me that you'll be searched on both ends of your journey, on both ends of your body. Sorry, that was a non-negotiable. Nadasha shrugged.
I was groped worse in college.
I don't know what to do with that information. I will say that if you do actually wish for the judge to seriously consider that your staying here is detrimental to your fragile mental state, it might help to evince a look of, say, detriment.
You're saying I don't look sufficiently fragile?
I'm saying that while I think your flat affect is generally a great look for you, for this particular audience, this one particular time, you might want to try a different tactic. Or don't, it's fine, you be you.
Nadasha considered her lawyer.
Remind me again why I hired you?
I honestly don't know, Lady Nadasha, but inasmuch as you've already paid me in advance for roughly the next 40 years, thank you for that, by the way, my wife loves the new dining room set probably more than she loves me, you might as well keep me.
We'll see.
Moving right along, assuming the hearing about your mental state does not take up the entire day, and it won't, as your judge rarely spends more than 15 minutes on anything if he can avoid it, I've arranged for you, along with your honor guards, to have use of my office conference room. I've arranged several meetings for you, including one with your mother, the Countess Nohama Peaton. Nadasha winced at this. Is this not to your liking? Doric said. I can have her moved off the schedule. I live in fear of her righteous fury when I do that, but you are my client, not her.
No, Nadasha said. I'd rather meet her on what's nominally my turf than on hers.
If I don't schedule you, you wouldn't be meeting her at all.
I think it's nice that you believe that.
Do you have any particular requests for when you're meeting her?
Have her searched for spoons and toothbrushes before she enters the room.
I have no idea if you are actually joking, so I'm just going to make a note of that. Doric made a note.
If you actually try to have her searched, you'll probably be thrown out a window by her bodyguard.
Good to know. Doric erased the note.
What about the other thing?
What other thing?
The other thing.
Doric stared at Nadasha blankly for several seconds before realizing what she was saying.
Oh, that.
Well, I regret to say that those endorsements you've asked for from your friends relating to your character have been hard to come by, and I think a few of your friends are actively avoiding me. So I'm still working on that.
Unrelatedly.
You may be interested to know that several news sources have been coming up with very intriguing information regarding your late and beloved brother Amit.
Is that so?
Yes, apparently your brother had been talking to several prominent underworld figures about the possibility of an insurance fraud on some of the house ships. It seems he had been embezzling from the house funds and needed to replace that money before it was noticed. Nothing a good destruction of a multi-billion mark spaceship scam couldn't solve.
Nadasha nodded. What did I tell you?
I can scarcely believe it myself, Doric said.
Nadasha smiled at this. The little dance Doric just had to do to make it look like he didn't know about her agreement with Darren Wu on the grounds it was a criminal scheme and he would be implicated in it up to his eyeballs, was sad and a little pathetic, but necessary. Who else am I meeting with aside from my mother?
Lord Terran Asan has asked for a meeting.
For what purpose?
He said he wants your wisdom about certain members of the executive committee. He's apparently finding a few of them difficult to reach a rapport with.
It's because he's an asshole.
That would have been my guess, too. Nevertheless, given his position on the committee, he's someone worth cultivating.
Doric raised his eyebrows at this last part to indicate to Nadashe that, in fact, Terran Asan was a useful tool, so maybe throw him a bone. Nadashe groaned.
Make the meeting as short as humanly possible.
You got it. Also, Lady Kiva Lagos' office called and was curious if you might make time for her.
Good Lord, why?
Doric looked at his notes.
She apparently has some questions about financials.
The house's financials were Amit's job, not mine.
Lady Kiva's office anticipated this objection and says they suspect you might have some insight that would be useful to her.
What is that woman up to? Nadashe thought.
She and Kiva were never close in college, even when they were in the same dormitory and Kiva was banging Grenny. They both instinctively understood that the way to harmony was to stay out of each other's business. Now Kiva was all up in Nadashe's business, and she didn't like it one bit.
You haven't already scheduled that?
No, I was waiting on your approval.
Then don't bother. Whatever she's doing with our financials, I don't want to be part of it or anywhere near it. Do you understand what I'm saying?
I will work hard to make sure you are untroubled by Lady Kiva's look into your company's finances, Doric said blandly, which meant he understood that the order encompassed rather more than just not taking a meeting. Then he looked at his watch. And that's all our time for the day. I'll see you in 2 days, Lady Nadashe. Avoid toothbrushes and spoons until then, and work on your sadness.
It doesn't take much work, Nadashe assured him.
And that much was true, at least. Gallows humor or not, flat affect or not, the prison life was getting to Nadashe. The prospect of this, all day, every day, for the rest of her life, was not one Nadashe wished to entertain. If it meant faking a little mental breakdown in front of a judge, that was a thing she was willing to try. One way or another, she was getting out of here.
What I'm saying is, it doesn't taste like fish, one of the guards was saying to another one as the transport bumped its way across the airless surface of Hub. The two guards had been talking about food for the last half hour. The third was slumped in a seat, snoring. Nadashe envied the third guard.
Of course it tastes like fish, the other guard said. Fish always tastes like fish. That's why it's called fish.
Right, but what I'm saying is that it doesn't taste fishy like most fish. So it's not as fishy.
That's what I'm saying.
Then it still tastes fishy, said the second guard, just in a different way.
No, you're not getting it,
the first guard said, and then turned to Nadashe to include her in the pressing debate about what constituted fishy fish.
Don't do it. Don't you do it. Don't you fucking dare.
Nadashe thought furiously at the guard, willing the goon into silence.
So let me ask you about this fish, the guard began.
And then there was a hideous bang, and the transport launched itself into the air and tumbled violently to the side. And all Nadashe could think about was how grateful she was that her final words would not be some asinine discussion about aquaculture. A few seconds later, she realized she wasn't dying, but that she was now hanging off the ceiling of the truck, because what was now the ceiling used to be the side, and she was strapped in and chained up. Her restraints had held up admirably, so she wasn't dead, and that was good, but the low, violent whistling she was hearing was telling her that the air was leaking out of the transport cabin, which meant she would soon be dead of asphyxiation. And that was not great. Nadashe looked down and saw the third guard crumpled in a heap, neck at an unsurvivable angle.
Went sleeping, she thought. How nice.
The other two were on the floor that used to be a side, dazed.
I need a mosque, Nadashe yelled at them. Hey, do you hear me? I need a mosque.
One of them, the one who was convinced that the fish was not fishy or what the fuck ever,
looked up at her, confused, and then nodded and started looking on the wall for the emergency oxygen masks.
"That's not the wall," Nadasha said. "They're at your feet."
This took a few more seconds for Not Fishy to process, and then, lo and behold, enlightenment came, and the wall-mounted case that was now the floor-mounted case with the emergency oxygen masks was found. Not Fishy put one on, gave another to, "No, actually it is Fishy," determined guard number 3 would not be needing one, and then handed one to Nadasha, who put it on with some difficulty, her hands being shackled.
"You stay there," the guard said,
and Nadasha was incredulous because what else was she going to do, shackled and strapped in as she was? "We're going to radio in." There was another hideous bang, and the rear doors of the transport flew away, and all the guards, living and dead, were sucked out into the airless surface of Hub. Nadasha grabbed desperately at her mask to keep it from flying off her face. Just before the view fogged up, she saw Not Fishy and No Actually Fishy had lost theirs and were simultaneously gasping and freezing to death. Speaking of which, the cold immediately began to bite into Nadasha's skin. Theoretically, the overland road to Hubfall was in the temperate twilight zone of the tidally locked planet, but temperate meant different things when there was a 500-degree temperature range. Temperate here meant blisteringly cold. There was a light in Nadasha's face, and then two people in spacesuits were all up on her, cutting through her shackle chains and restraining straps. Nadasha fell from the ceiling into their arms and was immediately sealed into a clear, bulky, full body suit that instantly flooded her with warmth and oxygen. Nadasha stood for a second, basking in warm, and then was hustled out of the shattered transport wagon. As she exited, she saw the bodies of the guards, all dead, and the wreck of the transport. This transport was manually driven. Given the shape of the transport, Nadasha assumed the driver was in the same shape as the guards, if not worse. Nadasha was drag-walked to what looked like a storage container with an airlock. She was pushed into the airlock and sealed in. When the airlock pressurized, the interior door opened and two more people pulled her out, replacing her in the airlock with a body missing a head and sealing the door to allow it to cycle. That done, they returned their attention to Nadasha, peeled her out of the full bodysuit, and took the oxygen mask off her face. The entire operation of cutting her down from the wrecked transport to unshucking her in whatever this was had taken less than 60 seconds. "Lady Nadasha," someone said to her. She turned and saw it was Lord Terran Asan, kitted out in his own suit. "Lovely to see you."
"What are you doing here?" Nadasha asked.
"Just managing your rescue," Asan said.
Nadasha opened her mouth to say more, but Asan held up a hand.
"Hold that thought," he said, and headed to the airlock, which by now had recycled. "Your mother sends her regards, by the way."
"Does she?"
"You'll be seeing her soon."
Asan gave a little salute at that, and then disappeared out the door. Lord Terran Asan was not going to lie. He was absolutely fucking delighted that his prison break scheme was working out as well as it was. And it was his plan. He was the one who had pitched it to the Countess Nahama Peaton. "Look," he had said, presenting the Countess with a visualization on a tablet screen. "This section of the road the hub follows is only lightly surveilled, and that surveillance is easily compromised. I've already had my pet hackers at it. I can make a 5-minute window where all the ground surveillance is down."
"That leaves the drone surveillance that comes with the transport itself,"
Tindaluan Tintu said. The Countess's chief of staff, as usual, was doing the heavy conversational lifting for the two of them.
"They send a constant secure video feed back to the correctional facility."
"Yes, they do," Asan agreed. "And that feed is both jammable and fakeable. You just need the encryption keys for the individual drones, which I happen to have, because the supervisor of the drones likes money more than she likes security."
"And then there is the satellite surveillance," Luan Tintu said.
Asan smiled.
"That was a harder nut to crack. For that, I needed someone who could give us access to the satellite itself, which means access to the military. The good news is, between Jason and Darren Wu, the Countess in her wisdom has chosen Jason for her favorite Wu cousin. In return, Jason has agreed to help, as part of his thanks for the Countess's favor."
"You're going to hide a snatch-and-grab from a military satellite," Luan Tintu said. Because when it doesn't show up on the satellite feed, that's not going to look at all suspicious.
It is going to show up on the feed, of course, Asan said. We're not going to hide the transport exploding, but we are going to fake the explosion and make it look like the transport is running slower than it is. So by the time anyone looks at the satellite feed, we'll be long gone. And we run the same simulation to the drones and the security cameras. No one will know to look for us because no one will see that we were there. They will only see what we want them to see. And what we want them to see will be a tragic freak explosion of the transport.
They'll notice if Nadasha is missing.
I've accounted for that.
How?
Asan looked directly at the Countess rather than at her chief of staff.
You might prefer not knowing the details of that.
How long will this take?
Luan Tintu asked. With the right people, less than 4 minutes on site. Obviously more time on either side, but those moments are going to be away from prying eyes.
And you're confident you can manage this?
With your help and Jason Wu's, yes.
What do you need from us?
Your assent and money.
How much money?
The Countess asked. Countess. This will need to be done quickly, and it will need to be done well. Doing it cheaply is not part of the equation. Asan got his assent. He got his access through his own and Jason Wu's connections, and he got his money, in amounts that allowed impossible things to happen so quickly and smoothly that it was almost magical. Asan was no stranger to vast sums of wealth, of course. He was the director of his family's holdings in the hub system. More wealth moved through his office on a daily basis than some entire human civilizations had had in their entire existence. But there was a vast difference between the daily and mundane exercise of commerce and the expenditure of frankly ridiculous piles of cash in the service of malfeasance. That Asan was doing this while being a director of his house and a member of the executive committee was just icing on the cake as far as he was concerned. The ancient phrase, getting away with murder, had come to mind more than once. He was getting away with murder and jailbreaking, and at least 7 other felonies. It was delicious, and Asan had never felt more alive in his life. It was a given to Asan that he would be on site for the extraction. It was a high-risk, high-reward mission, or so he told the Countess. He felt honor-bound to make sure that it was executed within the razor-thin tolerances of time and competence that the entire endeavor required. He'd already spoken to the leader of the mercenary team that would be executing the mission, and she'd agreed that he would need to be present and to oversee the final few minutes of the extraction and the execution of the finishing touch that Asan had brought to the party. Luan Tintu had been correct, of course. If Nadasha's body was missing from the transport, then no one would believe it was a freak accident. Everyone knew the Nohamapitans had money and power, and the belief that rules were more like guidelines and optional at best even then. Everyone from the Hubfall Police Department up to the Imperial Ministry of Investigation would stick their noses in if Nadasha's body went missing. So Asan discreetly let it be known, through agents untraceable to him, what he was looking for. A woman, Nadasha's height, weight, and coloration. Asan made it known he was not looking for a murder. That was splashy and would draw the wrong sort of attention. But if a woman just happened to show up dead? Well, Asan would be happy to know about it. It didn't take very long at all. The medical examiner who collected the reward assured Asan's agent that the woman wasn't a murder, but a slip in a tub, which... sure, why not? The woman was single, a drifter with no real friends and no immediate family. There was no one to miss her, including the medical examiner's office files, from which she was conveniently scrubbed. The woman, whoever she was, ceased to exist outside of the utility for which Asan had planned for her. She was delivered to the extraction mission without a head or fingerprints. Her circulatory system had been flushed, and her blood replaced by an oxygen-optional DNA-destroying accelerant, which was kept inside her body by the use of wax caps at the neck and fingertips. She was beautiful, and she would go up like a firework. There would be a body of the same size and weight as Nadasha's, but if everything worked to plan, it would be almost all ash. Even if it didn't, what was left would be almost impossible to identify as anyone, much less Nadasha Nohamapitan. In his spacesuit, Asan watched as his mercenaries put the woman's body into the remains of the transport, along with the bodies of the guards.
The whole truck would then be flash incinerated again in exactly the manner that it would burn if the battery pack went up because of internal structural issues. The battery pack didn't need oxygen to burn, which was convenient on an airless world. It was its own fuel, and to be sure, the battery